Good evening, everybody. My name is Mike Boatwright, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at Nava Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous of 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This is a reading based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way that they establish their relationship with God. This gives a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AA BlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So tonight's speaker is Matt P. And I don't know Matt from Adam's house cat, other than he said he was an alcoholic, which means I know everything I need to know about him, and pretty well could already start to tell part of his story for him, because we just do that, don't we? But I told Matt, I said, this is also the very first time he's ever told his story. So I told him that when he gets up here to either imagine one of two things, that y'all are buck naked, and if you don't want to do that, then just imagine that everybody in this room is looking at you and loving you back. So if y'all would send love beams to our friend Matt as he tells a story for the first time tonight.
I'm Matt. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hey, you guys. Like you said, I've never done this before, so I'm going to... I will say this, that this reminds me of my fifth step, you know, which was weird enough with one person.
General way.
So, yeah, very general way, yeah. So we won't get that involved. But I was born in 1966 in White Plains, New York. And, And lived up there for a couple of years, then moved to New Jersey and then to Pennsylvania. And by the time I was, like 7 years old, seven, in 1973, I lost my mother to breast cancer. And it was a strangely significant, part of my life and my story. At the time, of course, at that age, you don't realize, what that means at all. I do remember one thing. I remember distinctly not being able to cry, and it was really weird, and it had an effect on me for a while, until my dad remarried like 6 months later, and we moved down to Georgia, to Augusta, Georgia, and that was very strange. There was a little stop off in Houston, Texas, where apparently we lived with a college sweetheart of his, who I kind of figured we would stay there. Next thing I know, he's like, guess what? We're going to Augusta, Georgia, and I'm going to get married. And I'm like, well, who the hell was this lady this whole time? Your dad, What? Okay. Cool. And I hadn't met her yet. So off we go to Augusta, and I meet my new stepmom, and she seems nice, And the step family seems really nice. And there's a loving older woman they call Mama, who apparently is the grandmother, but she's technically not related to any of these people. I'm like, I don't know. I still to this day don't really understand how all that went. But she was phenomenal. And I truly believe that she is up there looking down and wants the best for me, as well as my real mother. And my stepmom's up there, too. I'm not so sure I can say that about her. But we'll get to that later. I spent summers with Mama. And I think that my parents... I know that my mom had a resentment against me as I had against her. She had already raised her children, and here comes this 8-year-old kid, and she's got to raise this guy. And... I'm not really a handful, but I'm probably a little smarter than she, and a smart mouth, and maybe not smart mouth. And of course, like all kids, especially kids these days, no gratitude, no nothing. You know, I didn't appreciate anything. All I wanted was more, more, more. And they would, I say, pawn me off on Mama for summers, and they would do some traveling and stuff. And that was fine with me. Mama let me watch all the TV I wanted and eat all the sweets I wanted. And I was in hog heaven. It was awesome. And she was a phenomenal lady. But as things turned out, of course, that didn't last very long because Mama passed away. And at the ripe old age of 13, I started smoking weed. And that, of course, led to my eventual downfall with alcohol. But the first two times that I drank, one was at the age of 13 as well, very alcoholic drinking. Somehow conned an older friend of mine to go buy me a quart of vodka, not a quart, excuse me, a pint, and a gallon of orange juice. And, you know, poured out the orange juice and put the vodka in and got smashed and barely remember any of that. And then another time when I was 14, I remember trying to hang out with these cool kids at school, supposedly cool, and drinking out of a Mountain Dew bottle. But it wasn't Mountain Dew. It was definitely some sort of whiskey. And I drank a lot, like most of this bottle. And so they were like, I was hoping they would be impressed. As it turned out, they were kind of pissed that I drank most of the whiskey. So, and that was kind of the way I looked at drinking. I didn't understand why anybody would drink anything that tasted like that, like kind of on purpose. I never thought it really tasted good, even beer and stuff. So to be honest with you, this part of my story, you know, marijuana was my DOC for the longest time, and I did it because I wanted to fit in. I definitely felt like an outsider, like a lot of us do. And so that seemed to get me in with the clique that I wanted to be in with, and I thought I had friends and stuff, and you know, we had a good time and all that, and that's how it started with me. I didn't have a clue until much later, until things changed, that I had started drinking to cover up, to just numb how I felt and to not deal with things. I was the kind of guy that didn't want to look any of my problems in the eye. That was not my forte. First time I really did anything stupid at school, I got caught, got suspended. Managed to get my first enemy, who was the guy that I was skipping school with, because as soon as we got caught, you know, they were like, who are you with? I was like, I was with Greg. And so that didn't go over real well. And strangely enough, he and I are still friends. You know, things turned out okay. But did all this through high school. Frequency got much, much more frequent. I started working in restaurants. That probably wasn't the best thing for me. But, you know, a lot of us do. There's nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, some people can do that and some people can. And the restaurant business, people have a tendency to go out after work and have a drink just to wind down. Most people who are not alcoholics can do that. I could not. I had no idea at the time, though. And I always felt like I needed a little something, not necessarily so that I could be more social, but so that my insides would match my outsides, if that makes any sense, because apparently I appeared calm, but I wasn't. Inside, I was like very nervous and didn't want to, you know, basically didn't want to be there, but didn't have any other place to be, didn't know any better. So that went on for a while, didn't realize that, you know, that is what was going on with me. My 21st birthday was absolutely brutal because back then you could drink when you were 18, but when I turned 18, they passed a law saying they were going to stagger the drinking age up. So I could drink for like something like 9 months out of the year, and then for 3 months I couldn't drink. And it was really weird because they would never card me at the bars I went into, until it was that moment in time. I think it was the end of September or something like that, and they were like, you know, let me see your ID. I'm like, man, I drank here last night, you know. But so that was really weird. But It was around my 22nd or 23rd year that I started to enjoy drinking to oblivion. I didn't even realize it, though, like I've said. And the thing that I liked about it was that it would slow down my mind, because I tend to have a mind that goes all over the place. And the pot wasn't doing that for me anymore. As a matter of fact, it kind of made me a little more thoughtful and stuff. And you know, as much as I enjoyed that early, after a while, it wasn't so enjoyable. So I got fired from a couple of jobs, and I managed to drink so much during this period that I can't remember the details of these things. There's a pattern coming up with this one. But I did get my first DUI somewhere around 90 or 91. And I ran into the back of a semi-truck on 85 because I fell asleep at the wheel. And didn't hurt anybody, didn't hurt myself, messed up my car really bad. But, you know, got DUI, went to jail, got out. Parents were like, you know, what's up? Yeah, you know, just bad judgment, Dad. You know, I said all the things that I knew they wanted to hear, so that everybody was okay. Of course, it didn't slow me down. That was my first time I ever came to an AA meeting, because I had to, right? We had to come in, get these little papers signed, all that stuff, and so I went in, I listened, I read the steps. I was a real smart ass then. I had to look at the steps and had my own little take on it. I remember there was a old timer in there, and he was like, kid, just shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. And I tried to fit in here, too, knowing that I had no intention of stopping drinking. I damn sure didn't have any intention of stopping smoking. But I would say what I needed to say. I would try to be a chameleon so that you people would like me and would accept me. And you know, that didn't really turn out so well. Somewhere around 25, 26, I had already decided that I was done with this. You know, that this whole thing, this life wasn't going the way I wanted to. I got another DUI. And went through all the stuff with that. Not long after that, I had a car wreck with my best friend in the car, and almost killed both of us. I have no recollection of that because I had a head trauma, so I had a really nice concussion. And then I got a DUI from that, although I didn't get it right away. Yeah, you know, so I think we're on three now, right? Yeah. So kept doing what I was doing, never thought anything about it. Actually started trying to make extra money by selling drugs. That didn't work out well either. Got caught doing that. And that got me in boot camp. I was the oldest guy in boot camp apparently ever at the time. But I was really, really glad they let me go to boot camp, because it was that or jail. And managed to get through the boot camp. I had a beautiful girlfriend at the time who was waiting for me, and I got out of boot camp, and she came and picked me up. She was late, and I was like, this is a little weird. But as soon as we got, of course, after something like that, you want to go get a good meal. We went to the restaurant, and my parents were there, and she was like, yeah, guess what? This isn't going to work. You know, I'm like, I'm supposed to be living with you. I'm on intensive probation. Yeah, but you can't stay with me. I'm like, all right, well, so that was weird. I stayed there for like a day, and I thought that my world was ending because, you know, she was breaking up with me and all, but ended up going back to live with my longtime friend from high school, and kept doing what I was doing, you know. Wasn't too long after that, I was still in the restaurant business, and I met my baby mama, and she was much younger than me, and my intentions were not good when I met her at all. Yeah, it was pretty bad, pretty scary. But so we got together, and I remember distinctly, it was the first time I'd ever had a relationship with anybody when I was like, you know, I'm not hiding any of my habits. You know, this is going to be done right in front of you, and I just don't care. So I'd pretty much given up at that point. And she didn't seem to care, which I thought was really bizarre, you know, because I would be like, you've got to be kidding me. Something's wrong with you. I'm running away. So, but she didn't run away, and she ended up getting pregnant, and we had our son, Tyler, in 1998. And I'm really glad we did. We weren't going to at first. And that was my idea. And I begged and pleaded and did all kinds of things that I'm not proud of. And I got another DUI, which was I won't go into the story, but it was pretty comical, actually. But it took forever for me to get out of jail. I was in there for like 20 hours. I finally get out, and she got me out, and she said, don't want to do what we had discussed we were going to do. And we're supposed to go get it done the next day. So I said, baby, that's great. Let's do this. You know, I always maintained that was her decision. So Tyler came into the world January 31st, 1998. And I drank a bottle of champagne by myself that night in the hospital with him right there. And, and so it goes. Didn't change a lot. Things kind of got worse. When she and I broke up, got a lot worse. Had my first major panic attack somewhere around there. First time I ever asked anybody for help. You know, strangely enough, I had to call first friend, didn't answer the phone. Second friend did, thank God, came over, got me. And took a little while, but I ended up feeling okay. And didn't stop me from anything, though. Didn't stop me. And, of course, during all these DUIs, I'm more or less staying in these rooms. I'm just not paying attention. So in 2000, I'm living at a place I found on Craigslist, nice enough place in Roswell, and we get a new roommate, and this guy comes in, and he is the most seemingly together guy, very meticulous fella, and he sits down with me in the den while I'm watching TV, like his second day there. I've got my bottle of liquor down right next to me over here, which I thought he saw the whole time, and he's proceeds to tell me about AA and all this stuff and how, you know, it's a good way of life and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, okay, so this is the light or whatever. This is my sign. I need to get sober. This is it. And I talked to him about it, and he's like, you know, if you want some help, I'll be happy to be your sponsor. And I'm like, okay. Knowing what I know about AA now, that was way weird. But that's how it worked. I started going to meetings and tried to do that thing. He moved to Houston or somewhere in Texas at some point about 3 months later. So I got about 6 months of sobriety on the marijuana maintenance program because there wasn't a chance in hell me giving that up. It was never an option. And at some point, I don't even know when. Actually, I take it back. I do know when. It was right before I moved to Savannah in 2003 when I started drinking again. And in order for me to do it where it was in any way enjoyable, I had to drink like twice as much as before because AA messed up my drinking. So that was interesting. I've managed to get down here. The reason I moved to Savannah was because my son and his mother and stepfather moved down here. He was still like, you know, 4 years old. So came down. We managed to somehow put him through private Christian schools through the entire time down there. And, you know, I say we, they. I contributed more money while I was down there and did more parenting while I was down there than I did through the rest of his childhood. So, but by the time he was like eight, he started having extracurricular activities and stuff, and so my time with him slowly but steadily started to decline. And I can honestly say that there were very few sober moments down there. And it's scary, scary stuff. You know, I would try to refrained from drinking like I would normally drink when he was around, but I still drank. And, you know, the promises are definitely true. I don't regret the past, but they're, you know, that they're, one of the things I've learned about recovery is that everything kind of ebbs and flows and comes and goes. But that's something that I wish there was a way to get back. But if it weren't for that, I wouldn't be here right now. And I'm glad to be here. I didn't have any friends. I was starting to isolate like you would not believe. I would go to the bar after work just so that I could feel good about myself and have as many shots as I felt I could manage in as short a period of time as I could, and then drive home to where my bottle was and then finish that off in oblivion every night. I was going through a good quart, a night. I ended up living with a very religious woman, and she was a great example that I did not follow. She cared a lot about me. We still stay in contact. That was a fun step nine. Things just kept going. I finally made a few friends, or you know, the kind of friends that we make. I managed to get one guy who thought enough of me to be my roommate and stay my roommate for a while. Things moved along. And one of the things that was a strange kind of byproduct of my trying to climb into that bottle was that I chose to swear off women and sex and everything. So I went on like an 8-year hiatus from all of that, of nothing but celibacy. So when that ended, which was, like I said, around 8 years later, things went a little crazy. And so there's some more 9-step work in there somewhere. But I remember I came out of that, and it was really ironic because my first girlfriend out of that, I was drinking so much at the time, and we had about a 3-month relationship. We were both fairly enamored, and I cannot to this day remember that person's name. So somewhere around there, I worked for a restaurant that would enable me. I worked at a place where I could go in so hungover that my day shift would end. I could lay in a booth and vomit profusely under the table, clean it up myself, and no one said a word to me about this. I got the feeling, well, maybe other people have done this in the past or something. You know, like, nobody said a damn thing to me about that. So that didn't have much effect on me except thinking, I guess this is not a big deal. But I managed to, I guess, pretty much give myself alcohol poisoning. And I was glad that I had. You know, I didn't go to the hospital or anything, but I couldn't drink for 2 days. So that run went on for 5 years. Marijuana went up, and I was not fit to be around. But somehow I managed to quit a job, get a better job, move on. My parents died. I got through that. I managed to somehow maintain my relationship with my baby's mama and be a dad. Not a good dad, but a dad. And it was amazing. And not too long, right around 5 years, I just said, I don't know why I'm not drinking, so I started drinking again. Well, things escalated after that. And I got to where, at the end, I walked out of a job that was a great job right before Christmas. I spent all the money that my parents had left, which was not a lot of money, but it was a chunk for me. I did something that I had never done before on my 48th birthday, and I actually did some self-appraisal and some self-assessment. And I tried to do that on many occasions before, but I couldn't do it. And I always had a bottle right next to me, and I still had a bottle right next to me then, but I let myself go there. And I came to the obvious conclusion: I was going to die. And do I want to, or do I not? And something said no. And So I had a friend of mine in the program. I called him. This was somewhere around my birthday. This was a couple of days after my birthday, and the 48th. And I said, I need some help. I need some help. And he said, I can get you to a meeting on, this was a Monday, he said, I can come hold your hand, is what he said, and take you to a meeting on Thursday. And I was like, all right, well, what the heck am I going to do between now and then? He's like, smoke up the rest of your weed and be done. All right, I can do that. So I finished off my bottle, did what he said, and Tuesday I got myself to a meeting without him holding my hand. I was kind of proud of that, but that was inevitable. It had to be done. Best thing I ever did. Did it without a nudge from the judge. Came in. I had the gift, truly the gift of desperation. I didn't want to go on like that. It occurred to me while doing the self-assessment that I had never had a true relationship, that I had never tried to do anything the best I could. You hear people talk about it all the time. You know, I did the best I could. I did the best I could. My honest rendition of that was I never even came close. And I didn't want to die like that. So I came in teachable and coachable. And I found a good sponsor. It didn't take me too long. But I did listen to quite a few people and took a lot of advice. Some of it was horrific. I mean, just unbelievable stuff that people would tell me about how to pick a sponsor. Some of it was absolutely spot on. Turned out the first guy that I thought was going to, I wanted, was the guy that I ended up picking. And one of the reasons I picked him was because he said that I come here so that I can live out there. And that made a lot of sense to me. I didn't want, as much as I'd love to live in an AA meeting, that ain't the way this works. I can't do that. But in early sobriety, believe me, I went to as many meetings as I could possibly get to because it was the only place that I felt comfortable. You know, I knew I was with kindred spirits. So we went through the first three steps while I was still in Savannah. And somewhere in there, my son moves back to Atlanta because his mother and stepfather moved back up here, new job, all that kind of stuff. I didn't follow right away. That was on the advice of my sponsor. I went to work at my last bartending gig, which was really not a bartending gig, but it was a daiquiri bar, so just slurpee machines. And I actually had a little fun doing that, but was glad to get out of there. Then moved back to Atlanta, started going to 8111, met some guys up there, listened, did the same thing I had done while I was in Savannah, and found a fellow that sounded like you know, he would make a really good sponsor. And it took me about 3 weeks. I finally asked him, and I'll never forget this. He put his arm around me, and he goes, I got just the guy for you. What the hell? I asked you, man. So, and it turns out I'd seen this guy and stuff, and I was very aware of how articulate he was and how he was from the big book. And it's like, yeah, okay. Yeah, why not? I'll give this a shot. And he is still my sponsor. I've only had two. I made some friends at this meeting. I took some advice. I got into the fellowship. I finished working the steps. And I remember getting to that fourth step, which I thought I was ready to do like the day I walked in to my first meeting in Savannah. I was like, all right, I got all this shit in my head. I got to get it out. You guys, you know, give me some paper. And so when it came time to actually do it, all of a sudden I'm balking. I don't want to do this, you know. And I remember sitting in 8111 downstairs in the dungeon and, you know, just going, all right, you know, how's this work? Where's my inspiration? So it finally got out of me. And when I got it done and I shared it with another man, and my sponsor, and I didn't feel near the relief that I thought I was going to feel. And so, and I, you know, I was like, okay, Thought the third step was going to be a lot of relief. Thought the fourth step was going to be a lot of relief. Kind of starting to wonder about this. Did the sixth and seventh step as described in the book? That's not a lot of words devoted to six and seven. Ironically, to me, you know, those are the most important steps. But I did them. Don't feel a lot better. On to the eighth step. Get the list done. Started doing the amends. All of a sudden, I start feeling a whole lot better. The weird thing about this whole process is that you learn about yourself. They say that self-knowledge in and of itself won't keep you sober, and I truly believe that. At the same time, it was indispensable to me because I had to learn about my patterns of behavior. What I figured out from doing all this was that the person I probably owed the biggest amends to was me. And that's a weird thing, because I managed to get through all of this stuff, and the sicker I got, the more I isolated. So I managed to not outwardly hurt other people except for them being my loved ones and going, yeah, I never hear from him anymore. You know, I wonder if he's okay. You know, but anyway, I got through all those. I called and did everybody I could think to do. My sponsor's advice on that was really good, because I didn't know how to do that kind of stuff. I wanted to call up and just say I was sorry. I learned to not say you're sorry and just say that you regret your actions. And there's always an I'm sorry in there somewhere. But and I found a life in these rooms that I never thought I would have. You hear that a lot, it's cliche, but it's true. The self-loathing from the alcoholic kind of drinking is just unbelievable. I really didn't think I deserved any kind of happiness. Since I have been sober, I've had a lot of good happen. I had a job that didn't really enable me to do anything except grow up. And I just left that job recently, and I'm about to go to a really good job, which is, you know, it's a gift of the program. I got married. We went on a honeymoon. We paid for our wedding. I've saved money. I always had a little money laying around. I was the brokest guy you would ever meet when I was out there doing my thing. And I came to realize that to me, what this program teaches me to do is to treat other people the way I want to be treated, and to keep that in check with that 10th step. That's all I ever really wanted when I was a kid. It's the only clear memory I have of being a child and having any kind of notion as to, you know, how I wanted to live my life. Of course, that all went out the window once the drinking really started hard. But when I got in here, that was something that I really wanted to do. I made some good friends in here. I've been extremely fortunate because I haven't had any tragedy happen to me since I've been sober. And I remember my first sponsor telling me he wanted me to wait before I did my fourth step because he wanted to see if I truly would rely on my higher power when something bad happened. And I did wreck my car, but my roommates let me borrow their car. And he was like, yeah, that doesn't count, man. So, I waited as long as I could. And which is weird because a lot of people think this is some sort of race and stuff. I remember thinking that. I wanted to get through it quickly. But I'm glad I took my time. I've learned to care about other people. I was one of those selfish people that would look you in the eye and be like, I'm really happy for you. That's awesome. And I'm thinking, I could care less that you are suffering some success. You know, you bastard, how can you do that and tell me about it when I'm sitting over here, you know, eating peanut butter crackers and stuff. So, that's honestly not true now. That's really weird. The whole higher power thing, I came in. When people would ask me if I believed in God, I'd say never met him. And You know, if it weren't for the spiritual appendix in the back of the book and the great quote from Herbert Spencer that says something to the extent of nothing will keep you in everlasting ignorance more, better, whatever than contempt prior to investigation. You know, that really struck a chord with me. So I decided, what the hell? You know, and my first sponsor kept telling me about just have your foot in that door. Just keep the door nudged open. Stay as open-minded as you can. You know, when you get here, they tell you open-mindedness, honesty, and willingness. And these are the things that I pray for every day. But there's one thing that I think is most responsible. God, you know, it's so weird. You think there's this one thing. It's this one thing. And it's a myriad of things. But my prayer life has been really consistent. I might have missed 5 days. And I've been sober for a little over 4 years now. And I don't know who I'm praying to. They talk about a conscious contact with, you know, a God of my understanding. Well, not understanding. I am at that point in my sobriety when I have to reflect back and go, wow, okay, yeah, I had nothing to do with that. You know, that was something bigger than me. Because when you're going through that, or at least my experience is, when you're going through that, you want to take responsibility for it. It's like, no, I did that shit, man. What do you... No, that was me. You know, that's not the case. But that's where the humility comes in. And I personally, when I have to do these reflections, I have to do stuff like this, and I don't know if you guys can tell, but I'm extremely uncomfortable right now. And so that I can, this caused me to look back at my life, and you know, before and after. And it's the gratitude, it's through gratitude that I realize that, man, I am really blessed and glad that I took some suggestions and managed to make it to meetings and willing to try to help other people. I've had varying success with sponsees. I guess that's going to happen. But there's a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson that I really like, and it is one of the beautiful compensations in this life that no one can sincerely try to help another without helping himself. And, you know, I'd like to say, you see, that's what this is all about. You know, but again, you know, but that's just one of the byproducts of helping others. You know, you can't do it sincerely without getting a little something out of it yourself. That's why they tell you, you know, you're going to help somebody else, it's going to help you stay sober. You know, and there is you know what I'm trying to say. There's no way this... Make sure you stay away from a drink that's better than helping another alcoholic. And I saw this thing on Facebook the other day, and I'm going to end with this. I don't know how much time. Did I do good? Oh, fuck yeah. And this just is kind of, you know, the way things have turned out for me. And so just because the past didn't turn out the way you wanted it to, doesn't mean your future can't be better than you imagined. And, you know, I used to think that would be, you know, this positive face of garbage and stuff. But things are going well. And if I stay away from a drink, then things are going to continue to go well. But I just keep doing what I've been doing since I got in here. I keep that prayer game up. I try to talk to people. I use that phone. You know, it must have been weird before cell phones. You know, you have to go to a lot of trouble to stay in contact with people. But I keep coming back. And I have no idea what else to say. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Matt. As Russell over at the Coco Group, and you all know Russell. Russell's been sober about 40 years or so, give or take. And he would say that was a good AA talk. Okay, I have asked, let's see, I have asked Frank to give out the chips.
Frank. I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hello, Frank.
And here at NAB, at the Blue Chip Speaker Meeting, they have these chips. They mark your time of recovery or your time without a drink. And they do them in a particular order here, and they all mean something. What they mean is they give you something to hold on to while you're going through all your white knuckle sobriety. I was told early on that if I rubbed all the ridges off this poker chip, that I could take a drink. I never was successful in getting any of the ridges to rub off. But. So if you try this thing, it's not drinking 1 minute at a time. I say 1 day at a time, but if you're an alcoholic, it's 1 minute. They give you this white chip. They got a lot of little cute things they say about this chip. But tonight you've got Frank up here, and not they. So if you want to try this 1 minute at a time, or if you're coming back, come get this white chip.
All right.
Now, after 30 days, they give you this aluminum chip. There's a lot of little cute things about this. I'm just not cute.
You're cute.
But after 30 days, you might be able to read what's on here. Maybe. So, anybody got 30 days? Damn it. That's right, there's a quarter when I give out chips. No, there's not. If you go to some other meeting and they give out these chips in a different order, don't raise your hand and tell them they're doing it wrong. They're different. We're autonomous. It means we do it the way we want to do it. This group does it this way. So after 30 days, or you get a silver chip. After 90 days, they give you a red chip. Anybody have 90 days? Anybody got 90 days that don't want to hug me? Alright. After 6 months, besides Julie, after 6 months, they give you a yellow chip.
Alright.
Anybody else? Damn, I was giving them out in twos. It's a Gemini thing. Yeah. After 9 months, they gave you out these green chips. My God, the green chip. Does anybody know why is it called the green chip? Because it's green. That's the only damn reason. It's green. I'll tell you a bunch of stuff, but you know. It's green. Anybody got 9 months? Okay. After years and multiples of years, I'm going to tell you this because it confused me. What the hell is a multiples of years? What is that? That means more than one. You know, more than, you know, your next year. It's like, oh, okay. I didn't get that when I got here. I was like, what the fuck is a multiple of years? Anybody got a birthday or celebration of years? Oh, my God.
He didn't have all that cologne on, so I could give you a big hug.
Yeah.
I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you.
And thank you, Matt. That was fabulous. Really, very. I connected with almost everything you said, except for the marijuana thing, which I didn't do. But I am the true alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is why I take it so seriously, I guess, and I take those traditions pretty dang seriously too. And I do that because I love this program. You know, in the 12 and 12, somewhere 6th or 7th step, Rusty can tell me where, it says something about how for most of us to get through the hard part of this program, which is the change part, 6 and 7, it takes a long, long time. Long, long time. And it's taken me a long, long time, so much so that I haven't got anywhere near the sobriety I think that most people should have it the years that I have. But, you know, but the best part about it is that it, you know, it keeps you on your toes all the time. And, you know, we're allowed to make mistakes now, which is really kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what you said about you didn't want to look back. Doing this fourth step made you look back. And then I had this revelation today. The worst ninth step that I had to do was this, my best friend's older brother. I just did some really horrible things, and didn't want to make that amends, but I did. And it was hard, but you know, it's not like I talked to him every day or anything like that. But I made the amends, and he's back in my life in the sense that I'm not afraid of him anymore, and I'm not afraid to be around him or any of those kinds of things. And I'm comfortable in my own skin. And you know, this is somebody that I did something to, and then they just like stopped talking to me for 10 years, right? And so I made an amends for that. And then today I realized I asked him to help me with something for business, a big thing in business. And he's like, sure, I'll be glad to help you with that. And, you know, I thought, that is the program in action. This is somebody that I wasn't able to even speak to, you know, who's now saying, yeah, I'll help you with that. So, you know, just keep doing the work. And life gets better and better. And then you wake up one day and you have 23 years of sobriety. Yes. So thank you.
Does anybody else want a new blue chip? Now, in case you're wondering why they call this blue chip speaker meeting, it's because everybody that speaks in this meeting has at least a year of sobriety. Now, in some groups, they offer the white chip for the second time. I don't know if this group, why? Because they're enablers. And a lot of times, a newcomer, when they're in these meetings like this and get a white chip, they're nodding off and they don't hear it the first time. Now, I don't know if this meeting does it, but I don't. If you want another white chip, you can go and stay with it after the meeting. All right.
See, y'all, Frank was here when I got here a good long while ago. And back then, he actually was cute. Yeah. We're getting old, Frank. We're getting old, buddy. Okay. Let's see. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting.
There's nothing more you need inside.